This episode of the CSUN Center podcast was recorded on 21st June 2022 by Ole Rummel and Mark McKenzie of the CSUN Center. You can listen to our other episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome everyone to the CSUN Center podcast. The title of this session is Inflation, Growth, and Financial Stability. My name is Mark McKenzie. I'm a senior financial sector specialist in the Financial Stability and Supervision and Payment Workstream at the CSUN Center.
I am Ole Rummel. I'm the Director of Macroeconomic and Monetary Policy at the CSUN Center. Thank you for joining us and listening to the latest installment of our podcast. Our aim is to share information on current topical issues related to the CSUN Center's three core pillars. And the CSUN Center is also a thought leader for central banks and monetary authorities in this in Southeast Asia and the Asia Pacific region. Topic foremost on people's minds at the moment, with the exception of crypto and stable coins, is undoubtedly inflation. And we are very happy to have two esteemed colleagues and academics join us today, who also happen to be good friends of the CSUN Center. I would like to introduce very briefly our two speakers for today. Our first speaker is Professor Hans Genberg, who is a professor of economics at the Asia School of Business, and he's also the senior director of the Central Banking and Finance Program. Hans is no stranger to the region, and he has published extensively on issues related to exchange rate regimes, reserves management, and capital market development. He has worked in senior roles in the CSUN Center, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, and at the International Monetary Fund. Hans has also been a professor of international economics for a number of years and served as the head of the International Economics Department at the Graduate Institute of International Studies in Geneva, Switzerland. And he holds a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago. Our other guest today is Professor Stephen Cicchetti, who is the Rosen Chair in International Finance at the Brandeis International Business School. He's also the Vice Chair of the Advisory Scientific Committee of the European Systemic Risk Board, a Research Associate of the NBER, and a Research Fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research. From 2008 to 2013, Stephen served as the Economic Advisor and Head of the Monetary and Economic Department at the Bank of International Settlements. So in addition to his academic achievements, Steve has been one of us, i.e. he has been a central banker. He worked at the New York Fed as Executive Vice President and Director of Research. And also he was the editor of the Journal of Money, Credit and Banking. Stephen has published widely in academic and policy journals and is the author of a leading textbook in money and banking, and also one of the brains behind one of my go-to blogs every week, which is moneyandbanking.com. And Stephen holds an undergraduate degree from MIT and a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. Let me start with the first question, which obviously has to do with the fact that there seems to be a perception that pretty much every country in the world is experiencing high inflation at the moment. However, that is not really true if you sort of dig down a bit deeper. Not everywhere on the globe has the same inflation experience. So the Economist wrote about this the other day, that of 42 big economies, eight still have inflation below 4%, and six of those are within the CSUN stakeholder space, which are Indonesia, Taiwan, Japan, Malaysia, China, and Hong Kong. So in this context, what are your views on the inflationary outlook, and where and how do you read things at the moment?
Well, maybe since you mentioned Asia, I can say a few things about this region where I live. I live in Malaysia, and let Steve talk about Europe and North America, where he knows much more than I do. You mentioned that inflation is lower in a number of countries than in the US, that's for sure. But nevertheless, it has increased relative to before the pandemic. I just looked at some numbers, and if you look at the so-called Asian Five, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines, their inflation rates, if you compare it to just before the pandemic, has gone up by about 2 percentage points. Now, that's not large relative to the U.S., where the increase has been something like 6 percentage points. If you look further down in the Asia Pacific, New Zealand and Australia is somewhere in between. And then, but then on the other extreme, there is China, where prices, inflation rates, as measured by the consumer price index, is actually lower now than it was right before the pandemic. So there is a wide variety, but in general, except for China that I just mentioned, inflation has increased in the region, not here.
So just to pick up on that, I think as Hans emphasized, I think that there is a significant global component to inflation. Backing up one second, I will say, if I look at the regions that at least I pay the most attention to, first of all, in the U.S., while headline inflation might be quite high, I think trend inflation is high. Trend inflation right now in the U.S. is probably running 4 to 5%, which is obviously significantly above a 2% objective that the Federal Reserve's Federal Open Market Committee sets. Euro area inflation is also probably running 3 to 4% above its 2% objective. But the euro area itself sort of shows how there's an enormous range of inflation experiences depending on the exact structure of an economy. So, for instance, if I look at the euro area, which is 19 economies, the euro area inflation rate runs from 5.8% over the last 12 months in France. That's the low end. Malta may be slightly lower, but Malta is very small. To Lithuania and the Baltics, which are running in ranges between 15 and 20%. Lithuania at about 18.5% right now. This, of course, creates a lot of challenges for the Governing Council of the European System of Central Banks, but the point there is that the range is quite broad. If I look then at Japan, which of course we all know had 20 years of experience where they've been trying to get inflation up to their 2% target, their inflation is now probably in the range of 2 to 3%, and they're probably, if I were in Japan, I'd be pretty happy about that. So some of this is good, some of it less good. But overall, I think that, returning to where I started, there are supply constraints and commodity price increases that are global. We have not only energy but also food prices, and we still have supply constraints and supply chain disruptions that have not resolved. If you look, for instance, at the lag in chip deliveries, it's still quite a bit longer than it was. There are constantly stories about bottlenecks in ports, about difficulties in obtaining empty containers because they're stuck in various places, and so all of those things are causing, along with lockdowns in certain areas that are affecting services, all of those things are causing inflation to have this significant global component, especially in what I would term market-based economies, and particularly in advanced economies. In emerging markets, of course, the energy and the food and the food proportions are, food especially, is quite a bit higher, and so there inflation will be driven in large part. You know, you have places like India where food accounts for something between 40 and 50% of the consumption basket on average. So obviously, when food prices rise, inflation rises, and that's clearly happening as well, and that's at least in part as a consequence of the Ukraine war.
Can I just ask very, very quickly, Hans and Stephen, your both seems to indicate that there is a wide range of inflation around the world. And Stephen, you mentioned the fact that in certain issues, the supply chain, the energy, these are seem to be global issues. So then what accounts then for the differences that we're seeing across countries in terms of inflation? I don't know if either of you could just elaborate a bit in terms of why is there such a difference in inflation?
Well, I think it is partly what Steve said, the difference in the composition of the consumer price index. In some countries, it's heavily influenced by food, for example, and but even within food, in some countries, people use more wheat than in others. In Asia, it's more rice-based, and the prices have gone up much more in wheat than in rice, for example. Then there are, in some countries, there are controls or subsidies, if you wish to call them that way, on energy prices, fuel prices, for example. So the increase in fuel prices don't pass, are not passed through into petrol prices in some countries, where they are passing through in other countries. So I think there's a lot of that going on that means that you see different headline inflation in different countries. And I should mention here in Malaysia, for example, there are also, again, subsidies, you can call them price controls. There were some price controls on chicken, for example. And that, I would say, distorts the numbers in some ways. Again, I think one needs to think clearly about trend inflation versus headline as well, as Steve mentioned in the very beginning, because there are sort of price increases or relative price changes in some cases that show up in high headline inflation, but that is not sort of underlying trend inflation. I don't know if you think that makes sense, Steve.
So, yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that a lot of what we're seeing is in fact, fairly high frequency noise. So so if we look at the U.S. case, you know, you see headline inflation running in the range of about 8%. But as I said, I think the trend inflation is probably at least 3 and probably more percentage points below that, in the range of something like 4 to 5. And I think that as Hans emphasized, I think that it's the structure of the economy, and also the openness and where it is that you're getting the products that's so important. So so for instance, while there's some food price inflation in the U.S., the U.S. is not just self-sufficient in food; it's an exporter of food, and so food price inflation is quite a bit lower. But if you look at the Baltics, again, focusing on the EU and the euro, especially the euro area, and the range of inflations there, which is bordering on 15 percentage points from the low to the from the lowest to the highest, what you see is inflation being higher in areas that are relatively or were relatively more dependent on Russia for various supplies. And so if you impose an embargo on a country for everything except for certain gas and some oil imports, then obviously the products that you're embargoing are going to rise in price domestically. That's a decision that you make. It's a choice that you think that your society supports, and I think in this case it definitely does support it. But it does generate this wide range of inflation, where a country like France, which is quite a bit more self-sufficient than Lithuania, is going to end up with far lower inflation.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Hans, for your raising the issue of price controls and sort of subsidies, which we would like to get back to in a little while. If I may, can I just before that, we've seen, as you elaborated on, you know, this sort of different inflation experiences, different reasons for inflation. Of course, what we're worried about as central bankers is inflation expectations becoming unhinged. And so there is a communication issue here that central banks really haven't faced to the same extent over the past 10, 15 years or so. I mean, any sort of best practice, any advice in terms of how central banks should communicate their policies, especially as, you know, what works for one country may not work for another country?
So I let me just start very quickly and say that I think that I want to emphasize that inflation expectations are a symptom of whether or an indicator of the credibility of the central bank's policy. They're not, they can't be a target. Then you're just looking in the mirror. So the issue that you raise, Ollie, I think is an extremely important one, and that is, how is it that the central bank can maintain credible inflation policy in a particular region or jurisdiction? And I think, as you suggest, that's going to differ depending on the jurisdiction. And I think that we are running up against some problems. In the advanced world, one of the things that led to that credibility was basically the success of, first of all, lowering inflation, which came, depending on exactly when you look at it, in the late 1980s or early 1990s, and then maintaining inflation through the last 20 to 25 years at something that roughly was around 2%, and also coordinating effectively in the advanced and economies on something like a 2% inflation. Obviously, in emerging markets, for reasons that I think are well known about the structures of those economies, they have to have inflation objectives that are slightly higher, but not a lot higher. But again, it's a question of how you maintain that credibility. You maintain that credibility by keeping inflation close to the objective. Now, then the question is, how are you going to do that now? Well, in some places, I think, particularly where I'm sitting right now in the United States, I think people, they've been relatively late. And so the hope is that now that they can quickly tighten policy, make it actually tight. It is not. It is currently accommodative. It is tightening. We don't want to confuse the level and the rate of change. But the policy remains accommodative today. They have to remove that accommodation as fast as they think is actually reasonably possible. In Europe, I think there are somewhat different challenges. And as I suggested earlier, in Japan, I think that they're going to likely let it go. But the question then, I think, does depend on local conditions, both political, cultural, social, and economic.
Yeah, but I mean, sorry, Hans.
No, I was just going to say, I think it is important in that context to emphasize that by the central bank, that you still have inflation as a target. That you're focusing on price stability, that you will engage policies that will bring inflation back to where you want it to be, and not start confusing issues by referring to special conditions and so on. I recall the debate in the U.S. about the transitoriness of inflation. I don't think that particular emphasis did any good. I think they hung on to it for too long, and it might have been better to have been a little bit more open-minded, if I want to call it that, from the very start.
Yeah, I'm more thinking for example, if I compare sort of two different episodes last week, we had a statement by Chairman Powell that was very powerful, very forceful. Inflation is much too high. We understand the hardship it is causing. We're moving expeditiously to bring it back down. We have both the tools we need and the resolve it will take. And then if you compare that to a now not non-European country that used to be part of the European Union, where the governor of that particular central bank made a complete hash of a statement, saying that, you know, basically there's nothing much he can do about inflation reaching 10%. I'm just wondering whether there's sort of a, you know, there's more that can be done in terms of, or what needs to be done in terms of explaining the situation and explaining the outlook and explaining what needs to be done, which is that, I mean, probably, you know, raising the interest rate will slow down growth and there may be a recession.
Mm-hmm. Well, may I just pick up on that question, Ole, in the sense that, I mean, both Hans and Stephen seems to suggest that supply chain is a part of what's driving prices as well as energy prices. And to your question, is, you know, well, how far can interest rate go to, for example, put truckers back on the road, put containers on ship? You know, can high interest rate actually address the supply chain issue if that is a part of the issue?
So I think I think there's sort of two separate parts to the answer here. First of all, I think that the answer to Ollie, to your question is that the central bankers need to be clear about their plan to bring inflation back, even if they believe that inflation will rise higher in the short term, which is what I think that the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey was referring to. I mean, obviously the UK is in quite a unique position because of the challenges associated with the continued Brexit impact on the domestic economy there. And the UK economy, of course, is extremely open, and much, much far more open than, say, the US or Japan. So if I look at that, I say, well, that's fine that you say it's going to go up, but then what's your plan? You know, and what does your forecast look like? And I think that in the case of, I agree that Chair Powell was quite forceful in saying that they're going to do it, but I still don't think that they have a very clear plan. And the reason is that I think that we have a lot of experience that it's that inflation does not fall unless real interest rates, that is, are interest rates adjusted for inflation, are positive. So at some point, interest rates are going to have to rise above inflation. And in the U.S., I think that means interest rates rising above 5%. And you're right that that's likely to come with something of a recession. Hopefully, it'll be a relatively mild one. I think in answer, Mark, to your question, I think that what we're looking at now is a very, I would contrast quite starkly the environment that we're in today with the environment that we were in the 1990s. The 1990s was a time when we had the fall of the Berlin Wall, so there was a peace dividend. We had we had technological improvement from the spread of the internet, which was improving productivity throughout the decade. We had the opening up of China and the increasing of trade even before the WTO membership, and so we had all these things that I would say were what I would call a positive supply shock, which is to say that they were lowering inflation and increasing output at the same time and increasing productive capacity. You're right that we have some temporary problems, but we also have some longer term issues associated with supply. And those are arising because of the fact that, first of all, there are geopolitical tensions now arising from the Ukraine war, which are going to really, I think, change things. There, for better or worse, is somewhat less. There are strained relationships with China. And there's a desire to to reduce dependence on these areas and to simplify supply chains, although diversify them. Those things are all going to be costly. And then in addition to that, there's climate policy where we need to make the transition to net zero. Now, all of these things that I'm mentioning, I think, will be costly, but will not increase productive capacity. So they are all the opposite of what we saw in the 1990s. So while it was easy to bring inflation down in the 1990s, it's going to be hard to keep it down for the next decade. And this is the challenge that central bankers are going to face. And they have to be clear about, I think they need to be, the most important thing is to be clear about how they're going to do it.
Let me pursue that a little bit and to say that all the factors that Steve mentioned that are obviously very important, I think are mainly going to affect the long-term growth, real growth prospects. In principle, they shouldn't prevent central banks from being able to reach the inflation target. It'll make it harder and costlier in terms of lost output in a transition from higher to lower inflation when you don't have these tailwinds that we had in the 90s. So then the danger is that central banks will see, and the public opinion in general will see, that growth rates are lower than they were before. And then there will be pressure on central banks to try to push up growth rates, but they don't have real growth rates, but they don't have the tools to do so. Those tools are in the hands of, in some cases, fiscal authorities or regulatory authorities, but not central banks.
Or in the hands of no one.
Fair enough, that's true. And therefore, there is a risk that central bank will sort of cave in to political pressure. I hope not, but there might be a risk.
Can I turn to what I would call the indirect effects of rising interest rates, sort of abstracting from inflation a bit? I mean, we've seen interest rates, we've seen monetary policy as a cycle of monetary tightening in many countries, and there are two aspects I'd like to pick up on. The first one is, in terms of what Hans already talked about, these sort of subsidies, price controls that we've seen, which may or may not be the right tools. I don't know how effective they are. Then there are fiscal costs associated with them. And the second point, it sort of comes as a two-parter. The second point is, we've seen, because we've seen this heterogeneous policy response, we have interest rate differentials opening up again, with effects on capital flows, exchange rates, especially for emerging market economies. And I would describe those as indirect effects of the inflation surge that we've seen. Would that be the right way to look at it? And how do you think about the effectiveness of price controls, subsidies? Is that, from an economic sort of welfare perspective, is that better than, say, the taxation of oil companies or policies like that? And, you know, how should emerging markets deal with the, you know, the sort of US dollar imported inflation with the dollar rising? Is that a danger on the horizon?
There are many, many parts to the.
should we split it up? I can do the first part, Hans. You want to do the second part?
Sure. Go ahead.
So on the price controls, I first of all, I want to make sure that we're clear that subsidies and taxes are the same thing. They just have a different sign. And I think they are quite different from price controls. In my view, price controls are rarely a good idea. They create substantial distortions and tend to conceal rather than reduce inflation. When there are price controls, inflation doesn't stop. We just stop measuring it. And in the extreme cases, it just moves into black markets. And regardless of what actually happens, once the controls are removed, prices jump to where they would have been anyway. And so I think that the controls themselves, while I realize that they're very politically popular for various reasons, are not a great idea. Subsidies and taxes are a different thing, because of course subsidies and taxes, or I should say positive and negative taxes, they reflect decisions on the part of a society and their politicians on what they want the structure of their economy to look like, which services they want provided by whom, and where they want production to occur. And so I have far less to say about those, except for the fact that some taxes seem to work better than others, and you want to tax things or substance that are in inelastic demand, so that you have to decide where you want the burden of the tax to be. I mean, remember that the incidence of the tax is not necessarily on the individual that where you levy it, and you should be very careful then about doing it. I'll leave the issue about capital flows and exchange rates to Hans
and all those stuff to Hans, right?
As long as nobody asks me to predict where exchange rates is going to go, I can say a few things. what we have seen, I think, and what is predictable, I believe, is that when U.S. and advanced countries' central banks raise interest rates, there tend to be capital outflows out of emerging markets. And that has an effect of depreciating their currencies, reducing the value of their currencies, which leads then to, or may lead to, imported inflation. So what do central banks tend to do in small economies like those in Southeast Asia, which I know a little bit about? They tend to raise interest rates alongside the interest rates in advanced countries a little bit. And they tend to intervene in the foreign exchange market to prevent the currency from depreciating. So that's where they try to use a multitude of instruments to protect their economy from the ill effects of surges in capital outflows, for example, and the effect there on the exchange rates. These might be such policies might be more effective in some countries than in others. So we know that where capital markets are completely open and there are no regulations on capital flows, the interventions in the foreign exchange market will have relatively smaller effects, and where there are some restrictions on capital movements. And indeed, countries have used some restrictions on capital movements also to make those policies of intervention in foreign exchange markets more effective. So there is this sort of move away from or use, I should say, of multiple instruments in certain emerging market countries, more in Asia, I believe, than in Latin America, where the idea of more freely floating exchange rate is much more sort of accepted than in Asia. How they're going to do in terms of intervention in the foreign exchange market, that's of course a different idea. But I just want to mention something that I saw in the local newspaper here today about Japan, which has a policy of trying to keep long-term interest rates low, as in long-term interest rates in other advanced economies are increasing. And apparently in the past week, the Bank of Japan has intervened massively, much, much more heavily in the bond market than they have in the past, in order to keep that interest, the growing interest differential from affecting local interest rates in Japan. So there are tensions that are building up in even in Japan, even though their inflation rate is not perhaps their main concern at this point.
Well, so, I'll just add one quick thing to that. I think that's exactly right. And just to add to the point about Japan, I think that while they do seem to be getting a little bit nervous about the yen depreciation, they're not that nervous. They may be more publicly nervous than privately nervous, because this is helping them quite substantially in getting inflation to their 2% objective. Remember, Japan has bordering on a quarter century of prices that they've been of inflation rates that were roughly zero, if not slightly negative. And so, and with unsuccessful policy in trying to bring inflation up, you know, occasionally they managed to get inflation to 1%, but they were mostly stuck closer to zero. And so I think that they're viewing this as a real opportunity. I mean, the trick is going to be to exit from that yield curve control policy that Hans pointed out. That is something that you're going to have to do in the same way that the Swiss did on their exchange rate policy, which is they're going to have to do it from 1 minute to the next. And we'll see how they manage that, whether it becomes disruptive or not.
Yeah, I was going to ask Hans if say other emerging markets attempt something similar to say Japan, what would that do in terms of wages, and would that kind of trigger some kind of wage spiral that contribute to inflation as well?
Well, if you mean yield curve controls in other emerging in emerging markets, I don't see that they necessarily will do that, because I think, with the exception, again, I'm speaking about sort of Southeast Asia and a few other economies around here. I don't think yield curves or bond markets are deep enough that it makes a whole lot of sense for central banks to try to exercise much control over them. Maybe they could, but I don't think it's that they are important enough in the economy that it would be a wise thing to do. Now on wage price spirals, I think that, again, in the local economies, I don't see that as a major threat at the moment. I would, if I were sort of a central banker, I would probably say that we are watching that very carefully and will take the necessary measures to make sure that it doesn't spiral out of control. There will be, of course, some wage increases if prices increase at sort of to catch up, but from there to a sort of ever increasing spiral, I think is a long way off here. May I ask a question of Steve about the U.S. and labor market pressures and wages and the potential of some sort of feedback between wages and prices? Is that a concern that one should take very seriously?
So I think that, first of all, I think that the labor market in the U.S. remains extremely tight, but it's tight in different regions differentially and in different sectors. And so in some areas, in some sectors, you have very tight markets and some not so tight. And you have wage increases and compensation increases, but they're not that severe, and they're certainly not bad considered. They're not anywhere near the inflation level. There's very little wage indexation in the United States, and very little in the way of unionization and coordinated wage bargaining. So the concern really is with the way that inflation expectations are working, and whether or not inflation expectations get built into those things. That's what you have to watch out for. And as of right now, that hasn't happened yet. But I think there is something of a concern. I would be careful which inflation expectations you watch also. Expectations in fact, I'm not sure quite where to look, because inflation expectations in in bond markets have been distorted by the bond purchase programs, and inflation expectations for households tend to follow oil prices. What's most salient for people in the United States is the price that they pay to fill their tanks. That's what you see. If I drive my car out of my driveway, if I want to go anywhere, I'm going to see anywhere from, I don't know, 2 to 4 petrol stations within about a kilometer of my house, and each one of them will have a sign. So that's the price that you see, and that's what affects expectations. So I think it hasn't happened yet, and I'm not. If the Federal Reserve can act expeditiously, I think it won't happen.
I'm mindful of the time, gentlemen, but I have one final question. It's a bit of a cheeky one. I mean, we've had sort of a very doom and gloom and bad news, and the world is going to end. I mean, are there any beneficial aspects of the rise in inflation? I mean, we know that that debtors gain when inflation increases. I don't believe there's sort of any financial stability implications of inflation going up, so we don't necessarily have to worry about banks. Any sort of other good news about inflation going up?
Let me try. the simple answer is no. And let me give one additional gloom in a financial stability area, and I'm thinking mainly about the possible consequences of rising global interest rates on some sort of poorer countries that became even more indebted as a result of the pandemic, and the potential for them to default eventually on some of their external debt. Now, I think a lot of those countries, I believe, are in Africa. And they tend to be small in the sort of global scheme of things. So I don't think that is going to, they will have a large impact of financial stability in advanced countries. It'll be disastrous potentially for the countries themselves. And of course, that is something we need to try to find a solution for. But honestly, I can't see any particular reason to think inflation has some good aspect to it in the current circumstances.
So, I'm going to answer somewhat differently. So, because I think that I agree that for a lot of emerging market countries that have been that, especially ones that are forced to issue debt or generally borrow in foreign currency, in a lot of cases in dollars, this is pretty bad news. Dollar appreciation and high dollar interest rates are going to make rollovers extremely difficult for those countries. Countries that have been able to borrow in a domestic currency, however, and borrowers in domestic currency, inflation generally helps. And I would put some of the European countries, even though the euro isn't necessarily a domestic currency, into that category. I have to confess, I'm a bit surprised at some of the spread increases inside of the euro area, given that the highly indebted countries like Italy are likely to benefit from inflation in domestic inflation inside of Italy. Especially because one of the big problems in a country like Italy is social programs, which are not necessarily indexed, and so this makes it a lot easier for them to meet their fiscal responsibilities. I would temper the financial stability conclusions by saying that while inflation, especially this inflation that's unexpected, is good for borrowers that have long-term have been able to contract for long-term debt at relatively low fixed rates, we clearly are entering a period where there will be a slowdown in activity. How bad that slowdown is going to be is hard to know, but the last time we had a slowdown in activity was the extreme slowdown associated with the with the pandemic in at the beginning of the pandemic in mid-2020. At that point, borrowers were supported by fiscal policies in the advanced economies generally, which reduced their default rates. The next time this comes along, they're not going to be supported by the fiscal authorities, and we may see the fallout of what's especially people that have hung on through the pandemic. I have to confess, I don't quite understand how my dry cleaner is still in business. But I take that not because I think everyone's like a dry cleaner, but because there are a lot of of borderline, shall we say, firms out there that were kept alive and that maybe will not survive. To the extent that they are indebted, the banks are going to have to worry about provisioning and non-performing loans, and that could have that could hit their capital levels. They of course are entering this period in some, but not all, advanced economies with fairly strong capital positions. So I think that, again, the financial stability concerns are sort of second order in the advanced world. But to the extent, and I agree with Hans, to the extent that countries have been forced to borrow in foreign currency, and those foreign currencies are appreciating and the interest rates in those currencies is increasing, then this could have pretty dire effects.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. Ole, I think we are more or less at the end. If I could just sum up some of what I've heard for this past hour or so, is that there seems to be a wide range of inflation across different countries around the world, and some of this could be associated with structural issues, issues like the supply chain, and rising energy prices seems to be global, but they're affecting different countries in different ways. On the last point, in terms of financial stability, which is one of our core area at CSUN Center, it's not a big concern, but we should not take our eyes off the ball. Very importantly, it seems to me that central bankers have to be very, very careful in their communication to ensure that they keep the public's and economic actors' expectations in check, and they don't set themselves up for failure. Ole, I think I captured as best as I could. So I think it's up to you to bring this session to a close, Ole.
Thank you very much, Mark. I would like to extend my gratitude and appreciation, as always, to Professor Hans Genberg and to Professor Stephen Cecchetti for joining us again. Both are always welcome. We always appreciate their involvement. We always appreciate their insights and their careful thoughts on topics of the day. So a big thank you to Stephen and Hans. And we hope to see you again. We hope to be able to inform you
I hope you'll join us again.
That's right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you and to Steve. It's been fun. I enjoyed it.
So thank you. Let me thank you as well. And let me just also express my hope that we do get to meet again in not too long in Kuala Lumpur, where I always enjoy visiting.
Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed listening to today's podcast. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. If you have a comment or question for our hosts and speakers, email us at podcast@csen.org and follow us on Twitter @csencenter.